And welcome to Bank Chat. I'm Hugh Chewett, and your co-host today is Anna Fenton. Anna, good morning to you.
Good morning, everybody.
Today, tax talk. Ahead of the budget and the chief executive election, there are a few new ideas about revenue raising floating around town. There's, for example, John Jung's negative income tax, for a start. What exactly is that? Why did it appeal to Milton Friedman, some libertarians, as well as to the Green Party? How about, for another example, the sliding scale for business tax according to the size of the company? How about letting first-time buyers off property stamp duty? Tax breaks for companies hiring young people? Tax breaks on health insurance? Email us with your thoughts on tax. Our address, backchat@rthk.hk. Our Facebook page is Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. You can comment there, or you can call us. And our telephone number is 233 88266, 233 88266. After 9:20, we're talking about fishing zones. Joining us now in our central studio, we have Kenneth Leung, who's a legislator, represents the accountancy functional constituency, David Webb, a shareholder activist, founder of website.com, and Carmen Young, who's chairman of the Taxation Institute of Hong Kong. Joining us on the line also is Professor David Cook from the Department of Economics at the University of Science and Technology. Good morning to one and all. Kenneth Leung, let's start with this negative income tax. A lot of people are saying, what is that? What, the government gives you money? And of course, that is what it is. It is where the government gives you money. It's a funny sort of thing, isn't it? What do you make of it?
No, I don't think it's funny because I think in the United Kingdom, in the US, they've been doing that. It's a kind of tax credit when your taxable income level falls below a certain threshold. In fact, it's a way, you can see it's a way of distributing social benefit. Some may argue that it's a more cost-effective way, something that it may not be. But it's part of a social policy, basically, administered through the Inland Revenue Department.
Yeah. Okay, all right. How is it different from a tax credit? A tax credit is what? Just money back on your tax?
That is a different because that is a social, motivation behind this. And in fact, apart from, subsidizing low-income families, there are other types of subsidies which you can administer through the Inland Revenue Department. For example, if there is a policy saying that every first child, giving birth and born to a family in Hong Kong
will receive
$5,000 cash, then you can use the tax credit method to rebate. So it's a very flexible, kind of mechanism. But of course, it is a kind of innovative idea in Hong Kong, and you need a lot of change in the infrastructure in order to implement that.
And the idea is that you'd replace other things with this, so it would kind of, in the end, it would come out
simpler.
You
do replace. You need to reveal quite comprehensively the social benefit framework at the same time as well.
Yeah. What do you think of the idea? Do you support it?
Well, I mean, it can be explored. It's quite a complex idea in Hong Kong. Of course, I mean, the other countries, they've been implemented it for quite a number of years. But
from my research, it hasn't been actually implemented. They've tested it in sort of on a small scale in various places. And I think there's some controversy over the results.
It depends how you recognise it. And Hong Kong's they're already doing it. in Hong Kong, we have something called the Low Income Working Families Allowance.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's a payment based on how much you're earning, how many hours you're working. And if you're working more than a certain number of hours, you get one allowance. If you go work even harder, you get a higher allowance. And it compensates for the fact that you're on a low-income job based on the size of your household. All this would do if we move the into a formal negative tax system is to move the responsibility from the social welfare department to the Inland Revenue Department. One department or the other would need to know how much the family or the persons were earning in order to calculate whether they're entitled to either the income tax refund or credit to the welfare payment. We also have the work incentive transport subsidy, which again is a subsidy based on the fact that you're working but not earning as much as is deemed appropriate for a basic living. Mm. It subsidizes the costs of formerly it's supposed to compensate you for transport from a housing estate in Tin Shui Wai or somewhere like that to where you actually need to be to work. But in reality, you don't have to prove that you're travelling that distance. You can just be working, living right next to your place of work and still claim it. And in the US, they have something called the Earned Income Tax Credit. So they do have a negative income tax system. They do make cash payments out to people who've filed their taxes and reported earnings below a certain threshold. So it takes place in various jurisdictions with different names.
And of course, there are all kinds of benefits, aren't there, from CSSA to little perks for this and that. And
yes,
and
even
so
I think
it's a very complicated system.
Before we introduced these the low income working family allowance and work incentive transport subsidy, we already had a system where if you earned less than a certain amount, it was disregarded for the CSSA calculations. So there was a sort of offset arrangement to encourage people to get out to work, even though they could still claim some top up from the CSSA system. So, you know, the problem is that you get layer upon layer of these things, and the governments are somewhat reluctant to clean them all up. And we've seen that with the long service payment system and the MPF, that they should have abolished the long service payment system because the MPF was meant to replace it. And you shouldn't be double dipping when you reach 65 and claiming both the long service payment and the MPF payment at the same time. And instead, both the main candidates, or all of them, I think, are not proposing anything on that, along those lines. They're just saying, well, we'll find some way to pay for it, or we'll create a sinking fund or whatever. We're basically going to pay twice.
Yeah. What do you think of the idea of a negative income tax? Do you support it, David Webb? Do you think
the principle is fine, and we have been doing it, with a low-income working families allowance. And, you know, society just needs to reach through its elected officials and legislatures a consensus on what the basic standard of living should be for someone, you know, who is doing their best but can't bring in enough income to pay for their livelihood. And you do need to allow for all of the hidden subsidies that are given to them, like very low rent housing in the public rental housing system. If you're receiving that, that's a big benefit that you won't be receiving if you're in private housing, renting a subdivided apartment or whatever. So you need to make allowances for those things in order to bring everybody up to the social safety net threshold, but without removing incentive to work.
Is it a problem that this would be moving from social welfare to inland revenue?
Well, that's probably a cultural thing between the departments.
I think the policy should still be driven by the social, you know, welfare department.
Driven by the government.
And the inland revenue is kind of, you know, becoming a clearing or payment system, I mean, at the end of the day. Yeah. And they need to verify the data, of course, of the taxpayers. And in a way, it is more efficient, maybe, or cost-effective for the inland revenue to verify your data, because it is a criminal offense if you file your tax return incorrectly.
Yeah, it does make sense to combine all of the assessment of income into one department. So that in that sense, it makes sense to move the other parts of the welfare system into the inland revenue, or at least have them certify incomes, and then have welfare department pay out the benefits.
And there's a certain kind of neutrality, isn't there, implied in it, that, as you say, it's not a question of where you live or making judgments about that, or much about your circumstances. You know, it's a standard. Everyone should receive this amount of money, and they can do with it what they want as well. There's, you know, freedom. It's not a benefit for food or for medicine or something like that.
In order to make sure there is still a work incentive, most of these schemes involve a partial compensation of the gap between your income and the target, so that...
Yes, I should say that.
So it's
yeah.
like Milton Friedman's proposal was 50%. There's nothing magical about
that's
that.
That's right. So it doesn't mean that everyone earns the same amount. Everyone earns a minimum amount. You could earn less. You could earn more or less.
But we don't forget, we do also have a minimum wage in Hong Kong. Yeah. Now, I still oppose the principle of that, and I think that it makes it harder for people who are worth less than the minimum wage to get work. That also means that if you are working the stipulated number of hours in order to claim the low-income working family allowance, then you're already earning a certain amount because of the minimum wage, unless, of course, you're self-employed.
Would this be an incentive for employers to pay less because they think they could get away with it? Because the government would top up the income?
Not necessarily, possibly. Because you already got the low-income family subsidy at the moment. I don't see any employer, being so unscrupulous to manipulate that at the moment.
Okay. Well, that's why you need to have only part of the... You only pay part of the difference, so you still have the incentive to go out and earn the other part.
Yes.
I mean, there is some marginal impact on that, certainly, that you might need to pay a dishwasher a little bit less in order to get them to come to work if they're able to claim the difference from the government, which they can't claim if they don't work.
Yeah.
So there is that effect, but it's probably unavoidable whenever you design these systems.
Carmen Young, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. What do you think of the negative income?
Well, I agree with all the speakers that this is a part of the social policies to help redistribute the wealth of families. It is a means of doing that. But having said that, I think whether it is effective, we need to review the policy, and there's the various type of proposal is how we want to introduce it to different level of income families. And now, one of the key things compared to the other country they have adopted is their like the country of U.S., they tax on various types of income. Whereas in Hong Kong, our income tax, personal income tax, is very simple. We tax only specific type of income, like employment income. But for investment income, like dividends or capital gains that they made by family or individuals, they are exempt from tax. So when we are considering the negative income tax, one of the fundamental questions is, are we considering only the income that they can make from employment, and we are ignoring all the wealth and personal investment?
Otherwise, we might end up with David Webb getting money back from
I don't have David in mind.
Sign up for a really low-paid job and then claim the difference. Yeah, yeah.
Because your income.
Well, that's why there's an assets test in the low-income working family account. So you've got to actually spend your savings before you can claim on that.
Okay, so Carmen Young, if you had an assets test included in it,
that solves the problem, doesn't it?
I mean,
you're not going to be sitting on a pile of shares collecting dividends and going out to work for $3,000 a month and claiming the difference from the government.
Would that solve that? Would that address that?
No, I think that require a lot of review on this, considering are we considering only income or the wealth of the families? And also, how does it work together with already this existing social welfare benefits for different type of people in
need? The gap in John Chang's manifesto was he didn't mention abolishing the things it would replace.
Yes.
And there's always a temptation to just say, oh, we'll deal with that later, and, let's introduce the scheme anyway.
I don't think he would do so in his manifesto to abolish some of the social benefit at the moment.
It would be, obviously, he would be proposing something that he believes is better. He'd have to demonstrate that it was better, otherwise, I don't think people would buy it. If they said, actually, this is a way to reduce the amount we're spending on welfare, then people would probably say no.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. It's, from the fiscal policy's point of view, how much is it as a burden to governments if start introducing the negative income tax?
I mean, the sad thing is that he's had the longest period of any recent financial secretary, 10 years, in which to put forward a lot of proposals to clean up and reform the tax system, and never touched any of it. And now that he's in the chief executive selection campaign, he's suddenly coming up with these proposals. It all looks a bit contrived and last minute, and he should have been doing these things when he had the power to as financial secretary.
All right, Professor David Cook, good morning to you. Thank you for joining us. What's your view as an economist of a negative income tax? It's got a funny kind of history, hasn't it, and appeals to unexpected people in unexpected ways. I mentioned Milton Friedman, the Green Party. I think it's being tested a little bit in Canada. What do you make of it?
Right. Well, I guess I think the key question is to determine what is the sort of basis for making this tax credit available. One is whether there should be tax credits available to people who don't work or are unemployed, or whether to reserve it to people who are actually working and earning income. The second issue probably is to think about the family issues, to think about whether this should be available to people without children or whether it should be more generous to people with children, which from an economist's point of view might be viewed as distortionary, but maybe tends to be politically more popular to limit it or emphasize it for people who actually have children to support.
Well, the Hong Kong scheme does do that. It has a child benefit, child allowance, and it's that's also linked to the number of hours that the adults are working and whether they're single parent household or two parent household. So it does allow for that. And I mean, Friedman's proposal was basically as a replacement to the problem of welfare, where you actually pay people not to work, without any real incentive to get them to work, and this provides the incentive to you know, at least to maximize your own productivity and then claim on the state.
Right. Well, I mean, I think Friedman actually did oppose making it conditional on working, because it was just a matter of making decisions for people, which he kind of opposed. But it is true that in the United States that it's much more generous for people with children. So it is part of an overall family plan.
And that's right, because what you're doing is bringing up the next generation of taxpayers when you do this. You're paying the costs of you know, clothing, feeding, and housing a child who one day will enter society and be part of the workforce and be productive and pay tax him or herself. So. You know, there is an expense involved in that, and it's right that mm-hmm. people should be compensated if they can't afford it themselves.
But David,
right? Well, I mean, then, but that's, I guess, true for people across the income spectrum.
Yeah.
So there's another issue there.
Why we have personal allowances in the income tax system, which depend on the number of children you have, as well as the number, whether you're married or not. So you deduct from your income before tax. A certain amount based on the number of children in Hong Kong.
That's right.
And that most systems have that to again compensate for the cost of raising the next generation of taxpayers.
So this next generation of taxpayers, are we not losing sight of the bigger picture here? Is that these low-income jobs are the ones that are going to vanish due to automation and more technology? Should we not be spending this money on upskilling and training people for a new generation of much less jobs in this sector?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's an either-or situation. I think that it is probably true that we should be thinking about expanding what sort of educational opportunities are available to young people, and that's likely to occur as the number of young people decline in any case. But I don't think...
Now you're into education policy, and on that, Friedman proposed, and I support, the education vouchers, which Hong Kong has dabbled with. We do have some form of voucher system for kindergartens. Unfortunately, there were too many constraints put on it by the government, but they should be adopting that policy all the way through the education system, shaking up the unionized school system that we've got, and making bad teachers leave and good teachers come in, and have the schools compete for the voucher, which follows the student around. If you do that without disturbing the fact that the government pays for nearly everybody's education, and taxpayers pay for that, you can still introduce competition and produce a better result than we're currently producing, because to Anna's point, there will be fewer jobs for low-skilled people, and we need to raise the skills level and get everybody to achieve the highest level of educational attainment that they can get given their
right
situation.
Well, I agree. I think that maybe in terms of a negative income tax or some type of earned income tax credit, that maybe it's better to think about it as a substitute for the MPF scheme, which does seem to offer some sort of direct disincentive for low-income people to work. Does seem to be a burdensome tax on them, and does seem to be quite inefficiently implemented.
Actually, it doesn't, because they don't have to contribute below a certain income threshold.
Yeah,
to the
MPF
system.
Still, employers have to contribute below,
yes.
And the actual income level below which you don't have to contribute is pretty low relative to the monthly wages of an.
Well, as you probably know, I've always said we should just abolish the MPF system. It was a welfare system for fund managers, not for people.
Right. So. I mean, it may be possible to implement some sort of negative income tax system as a substitute for the MPF in some way to encourage people to save for, or even require people to save for their income, but for their retirement.
Well, I think the idea of the negative income tax is to afford your current cost of living, not your future costs.
Yeah, because people don't necessarily save up for them. extra money they get every year.
No,
every
it's not here's the money to put in the bank, it's here's the money to pay for your food.
Professor Cook, this has been, I think it was tested a little while ago, perhaps in the 70s or 80s in Canada, and the suggestion is that Pierre Trudeau is going to do another kind of test run. I think it's been mentioned by the Canadian government. So this is something that's, you know, that is around at the moment. So John Jung seems to be right in saying this is this is in the air at the moment. But although it's contentious, one suggestion question is that when they tried it before in Canada, what happened was that people, instead of working, washing up, I think, for 5 days, they started washing up for 3 days because it wasn't worth... them working for 5 days because their income would be topped up. Maybe they'd lose a little bit of money, but they'd still get an extra 2 days off. So it's a very fine balance, isn't it?
I think that's why the North American countries kind of opted for tax credits for people who are actually working rather than a pure negative income tax as originally proposed, was that the initial experiments with them did show that there was a significant negative impact on labor supply, as you might expect.
This happened in the UK as well, where it got to the point under tax credits that a postman earned more just collecting tax credits and doing a little bit of part-time work than actually having a job.
Badly designed system, haven't you? I mean, that's the Hong Kong system does require, I forget the numbers, it's something, the highest level is 144 hours a month of work. So, which is about 8 hours a day for 25 days a month if you're working a six-day week.
It'll get like in Ireland, where you have what's called doing a nixer, which is where you go to work for the required number of hours legally and the rest is under the table money and not booked.
Well, obviously, if people are going to cheat the system, they should be sent to jail. But, you have a system for prosecuting welfare fraud. And I misspoke. It's 194 hours for the highest allowance. So, and 144 for the lower level of allowance.
But I'm curious, Professor Cook, do you think these problems are solvable? Do you think it's worth trying?
I think that we do monitor, that's one of the reasons that I mentioned the MPF, is that we do monitor the income from the employer side through that already, that people are required to submit that. So, my understanding is that that's being, at least on the side of full implementation, that there's not, that it's not a significant problem of people working off the books.
Well, what about this other idea, and maybe we'll come back to the negative income tax, but what about the other idea of a sliding scale progressive tax for business rather than a flat rate? How do you feel about that?
I think that, for people who are truly running personal businesses at low income levels, probably it's good to have a sliding tax scale that's comparable to that for comparable workers. But I think it's a terrible idea to have lower tax rates for different levels, sizes of businesses. Having a clean flat tax is going to be the best way to have a competitive environment and to minimize the actual costs of the tax system on production.
Carmen Young, I think the Taxation Institute has a different idea.
Yeah, we have been proposing to adopt a two-tier tax rate for corporate for years. The reason being, number one is we want to support SME because a lot of our corporations in Hong Kong are SME. 10% of our corporates are actually paying tax, and majority of them SME, but they're contributing only about 50% of less than 50% of the revenues. It's a small number we're talking about, which we want to give a release. And one of the reasons this SME is important to us is they are employing like 50% of our workforce in Hong Kong. And as a general policy, we want this group of SME will have a growth, and there will be lessening the burden in order to support economies and also stabilize the employment market in Hong Kong. It's a similar effect of the progressive tax rates, but it depends on how you draw the line. Do you want to use a progressive tax rate based on the profits that they earn every year, which to the government will be rather difficult to project the revenues that they will be able to collect. Whereas in the two-tier tax system, we will draw a line based on the size of our corporations. And then, like the proposal that our institute has submitted is we would like to draw a line based on the scale of the revenues and the size of the company. And the tax rate we're proposing to give to SME is 10%, which is 6.5% lower than the flat rate that we have adopted in Hong Kong.
It's a stupid idea, really. I mean, I would expect accountants to say it's great because it involves a lot more work for them trying to figure out how to game the system. But a flat rate of profits tax, which should be lower, and so should salaries tax. We're collecting too much revenue as it is. But a flat rate is far simpler. If you have these so-called progressive rates, then you struggle, first of all, to define what is an SME. I mean, if you base it on revenue, then a retailer with only a 2% profit margin is going to have very high revenue and low profits, and they're going to qualify. Whereas a business that has a high profit margin will have much lower revenue and won't qualify. And so you get into those problems. You also get into the fact that larger companies can divide themselves into subsidiaries. They can have a separate company for each shop that they run, for example, and each of them can be an SME, only employs 10 people, only has a certain amount of revenue. Whatever criteria you put in place, you can say that particular company, although it's owned by a bigger one, qualifies. And so people then game that. And also, they would try to, if they had a good year and they're in danger of reaching the next tax level of on a progressive scale, they try and shift their profits into the following year. But by manipulating their accounts, which accountants can help them with, but that's not.
Kenneth Lung, levels, it's bad. Kenneth Lung, 10 seconds. Have you fought against it?
I think the cost. I mean, even taking into account what David said, I mean, even if dodging the system is really low. But you can give the lower rate to single companies which does not belong to any group of companies. I mean, that could avoid people
to avoid
dodging
subsidiaries.
Yes.
Okay, well we'll follow up on that in a few minutes' time after the news at 9 o'clock. We're just going to break. Before that, the latest weather. We're also going to be talking about that proposed fishing zones in Central and in Taipo on the waterfront. The weather forecast, mainly cloudy with a couple of rain patches, visibility relatively low in some areas. Winds will become northerlies tonight. Temperatures will begin to fall significantly. 17 degrees now, humidity at 81%. Welcome back. This is Back Chat on a Wednesday morning. We're talking about tax. There's a few ideas about new ways of raising revenue floating around. We've been talking a little bit about negative income tax. That was something that John Jung had mentioned in his manifesto. Also, the idea of a sliding scale for business taxes. That's come up with the Taxation Institute. Then there are ideas like letting first-time buyers off property stamp duty as well. We'll talk about that in a moment. Tax breaks for companies hiring young people. Tax breaks on health insurance. We're talking about the issues with Professor David Cook from the Department of Economics at the University of Science and Technology, Carmen Young, who's chairman of the Taxation Institute of Hong Kong, David Webb, who's a shareholder activist and founder of website.com, and Kenneth Lung, who's a legislator who represents the accountancy functional constituency. We're going fishing later, talking about the development of fishing zones in Taipo and in Central with, among others, the author of the book Fishing in Hong Kong. You can contribute. We'd like to hear from you. Email us, backchat@rthk.hk. We'll read out your messages, or you can go to our Facebook page and comment there. That's Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, or you can call us, and our telephone number is 233-88266. That's 233-88266. Just one comment from Jalal, who says no taxation without universal suffrage and full representative democracy, says Jalal. Thank you for that comment. Once again, our email address, backchat@rthk.hk. Carmen Young, did you want to, or Kenneth Lung, did you get the say all you wanted to say about the idea of a sliding scale? You were defending it, more or less.
Yes, I think there's a role for SMEs to play, of course, in Hong Kong. And on top of that, don't forget that it is a political gesture. It doesn't cost the Treasury a lot of money, and is a way to appease some of the SMEs. I mean, so be it. I mean, economically, David may have other ideas, but
well,
just
let's be irrational to make people feel better. Is that the idea? You know, what we actually need is a simple tax system that's easy to calculate and doesn't involve armies of accountants that cost money, either at the Inland Revenue or in the private sector. And not to fiddle around with the rate system. And on salaries tax, we could do the same thing. Currently, we have multiple rates, 2%, and then 7%, and then 12%, and 17%. And in fact, we have a regressive system because you pay 17% until you reach a certain level, and then you go down to 15%. And that's just nonsense. I mean, I think we need a simple, flat flat rate of tax, and you can abolish the lower bands of taxation so that nobody pays more than they currently do. And then we need to look at whether we're collecting too much in the first place, which we are, because over the period of John Chang's financial secretary position, we've racked up hundreds of billions of reserves. That's just being stashed away and not returned to the economy to put it to good use. So the best thing that the next administration and financial secretary could do would be to introduce a 10% flat rate of tax for salaries and profits or something of that order, and run the reserves down for about 10 years.
But it's generally accepted just about everywhere in the world, isn't it? 90% of the places in the world, that you have a progressive tax system when it comes to individuals. Why don't you apply the same logic to businesses?
Just because other countries have got it wrong doesn't mean that we should.
You want to encourage the SMEs, as we've been hearing. They play an important part in employing.
Of course, they're encouraged. If they make a profit, they make money.
Why should they be treated in the same way as Li Ka-shing's?
They have the same incentive, but as Li Ka-shing does, to make money out of their business. I don't see why the government should then, taxpayers basically should rebate some of their tax obligations if they do make a profit. Why make it so complicated? If a company has a good concept, a good business, it's likely to grow anyway, it gets to keep already 83.5% of the profits it makes. Is it really going to make much difference if you get them raise that from 83.5 to 85 or 90? It doesn't. That's not going to make a difference between survival and failure. And we shouldn't be adopting any policies that try to prop up failing or unviable businesses, which we do with things like the SME loan guarantee scheme. I mean, that's just nonsense. We're putting taxpayers' money at risk to support businesses where their owners cannot justify their existence, basically, and they should be doing something else with their time.
Anyone want to
just to jump in on the distribution issues? The biggest companies are public companies, and many of the shareholders of them are going to be considerably lower down on the income scale than many of the owners of small or medium sized enterprises. So it's not clear that you're robbing from the rich and giving to the poor with some sort of adjustment of or some sliding scale for the size of the enterprise.
Because the money from the profit gets distributed to
the shareholders, many of which are going to be are not going to be rich people at all.
Carmen Yang?
Well, I think just want to echo to what respond to what David mentioned is the two-tier systems. Even though we introduce it, I still see Hong Kong is still following a simple tax systems. I mean, David have been long enough for Hong Kong that he forgot about all these foreign countries. They have very complicated corporate income tax and personal tax systems.
But that's their problem, not ours. I mean,
this is objective of the tax policy. Are we going to impose the same level of tax for everybody, regardless of the size of income, or we want to promote SME in order to achieve some other objective for the economies?
I think if you introduce a 10% flat rate of tax, there'd be no complaints from SMEs about that. They wouldn't resent the fact that larger companies also pay 10%. So why don't we just do that and stop arguing about whether we should have progressive rates above that level? There's also, the government's already been tinkering with this because, as Carmen pointed out during the break, because they've been collecting so much tax, they've been doing these sporadic rebates in the budget, but they've been capping the rebate at $20,000 per company or per profits taxpayer. Whether you're a company or a partnership or whatever. And that basically effectively reduces the tax rate more for SMEs because they pay, or people who make less profit. And don't forget, large companies can make slim profits on occasions as well. So, there's no reason why a big conglomerate through one company wouldn't make a small amount of profit in 1 year.
Okay, our number is 233-882-66. We've got a caller on the line now, James. James, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Hugh. For many years now, I've been contacting the chief executive and said, look, we've got a rich government here. Why the hell is it that we have no tax break on education? You're forced by law to send your children to school. Some of us don't have a choice. We have to go to an English language school. We pay a vast amount of money. I have three kids. And then the government taxes you on that income that you spend on the school, the schooling, which is ridiculous.
Yes, it's wrong. I mean, I think that's where vouchers would solve the problem, because every child and would receive a voucher which they could spend either in the private system, as you do, or in the public system. And that would basically reduce, if you want to top it up, then you do it out of your earned income. But otherwise, that part won't be taxed.
Yeah, but to be fair, I think we spend quite a lot on education already. I mean, there's come, of course. I mean, when you talk about the English language schools, I think it was wrong to scrap the subsidy to ESF. But of course, that was quite a political decision, because expatriates, you know, coming to Hong Kong, they need a reasonably priced, you know, education system, and the ESF has filled the gap, has been doing well, but for various political reasons, the subsidy to these schools was withdrawn gradually, and I think it was a wrong decision.
Yeah, but they never introduced that subsidy for the other private schools. That's what they should have been doing, is saying, look, we're going to give a voucher. You can spend it in any of these private schools or in the state school system, and we're going to be agnostic to that. But as you, as your caller James has pointed out, he has to pay his own salaries tax on the money that he would spend on education before he spends it, and that's unfair. So a voucher system would solve a number of ills, including introducing competition between the somewhat moribund and poor product public education system, as well as the private one. There's an ongoing issue with basically the iron rice bowl approach to people in state-funded schools. I think they view it as a sort of job for life, and they don't compete too hard and to maintain their standards.
James?
Yeah, I totally agree. I raised that point. I even wrote to the chief executive saying, look, it should be fair to everybody. And it's not just expatriates now. The a lot of local people are not happy with the education system. I mean, they're complaining in America at the moment, this DeVos woman has got no expertise of education, and that's exactly what we have in our government here. We take somebody from human resources and make him in charge of education. So, I mean, you have a system here which is broken. It needs to be resolved. Yeah. If they can spend $50 million on a singing fountain in Kuntong, for heaven's sake, and waste money like this, surely they must be able to just say, okay, we'll give a waiver on the education. And the way we'll do it is to, as mentioned before, is to give vouchers. Everybody gets a voucher.
Wouldn't it be better to,
wouldn't
be better to make the schools better and to have high-quality English medium schools and so on, and schools which catered to non-Chinese speakers and things like that, to invest it into that rather than giving tax breaks?
Well, they withdrew the subsidy because they said that the English language schools here, or the American schools, were teaching their own
curriculum. Yeah,
actually, that's nonsense, because there's also a scheme called DSS, direct subsidy schools,
which goes to IB. Yeah,
and yes, a number of schools are teaching international baccalaureate, which is an international curriculum on that subsidy. So it's an inconsistent approach across the board.
Well, you've got a LegCo member here. Let him raise it. Do something about it.
Well, I think first of all, I think I do agree that the education chief should be replaced, and the sooner the better. And few months' time, and then we need to review how we are going to subsidize, you know, people. I mean, either through the voucher system or through various ways to improve the quality of teachers, the hardware and the software. I mean, spending money on education is only one of the measuring criteria for whether we got a good education system, because I've have been feeling that, you know, the bureau has been micromanaging, you know, the schools too much for the past many years. And then let the school do make their own decision.
Okay. James, thank
you. There was a program I watched recently by Michael Moore, and it's very interesting. It's Where Shall America Invade Next? And he goes to Europe, and he goes to Finland. And the education in Finland for everybody is free. Not just that, they have the highest level of education results in the world, and they have no homework.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, so it's going to tell you something. Why don't they?
Let's talk about stamp duty.
We've got the frequent travelling fast Eddie, who's now caught up on our former environment minister in the number of trips made abroad. But what's he doing when he goes abroad? Why doesn't he go to these places?
I think he
if
has
to go to France. Anyway, really?
Okay, right. James, we take your point. Thank you very much indeed for giving us a call on number 233-88266. Joe Average in an email says, stop giving all the tax away. One, sort out the medical system, make it the best in the world. Two, buy all the food markets. We want cheap food. Three, sort out all the education system. No fees, no booking charges, no extras. Four, buy all restaurant buildings. Five, buy the MTR and the tunnels. Six, sort out old age homes and pensions. Sort out the system from the bottom. All I see is government officials having big pay rises. That comes from Joe. And Peter says, Webb suggests that long service payments should be abolished since retirees will be getting two bites of the cherry with their MPF. Surely the business pressure to retain the offset arises from the fact that long service payment is much more important to retirees than their MPF benefit, asks Peter. David Webb, do you want to respond to that?
The level of MPF contributions in the first place was designed to basically match the amount employers were already setting aside for LSP. The difference is they actually had to put the money into the fund rather than preserve it in their accounts okay. as a provision.
There's quite a few issues. One more which is raised in an email finally by Sam, who says, Dear Backchat, why can there not be some sort of rebate for persons who pay house rent out of their earning? There is a rebate on rates or waivers for landlords whose only concern is to raise rent every 2 years. In the income tax return, there is no place to declare as well. Housing prices are beyond the average person's.
Right.
John Jung done sitting on people's money for 9 years instead of putting in place a pension scheme to enable senior citizens to go and live elsewhere, as the government is unable to provide suitable housing to such elders? If John Jung wants to become chief executive, to idle for another 8 years, no way, just unable to think outside the box. That comes from Sam. Carmen, yeah, I did want to mention another of your proposals in the Taxation Institute, which is letting first-time buyers off property, off stamp duty. What's the logic there?
Well, I think the concept of introducing double stamp duty initially back a few years back is to trying to cool down the speculation on property markets and also addressing the people who really in need of the properties is to lessen the burden by waiving the stamp duty. So in our proposal, we do provide some conditions, hopefully, that will help address this objective. One is this is first-time home buyer, and they have a cap of investing in a property less than 6 million Hong Kong, which is a small flag based on the nowadays standard. And, I think that the moment the cost of property is so high to a lot of families that they can't find it affordable. And yet, if we're still introducing stamp duties and double it for certain sizes, then it will be adding the burden to family.
Kenneth Lang, what's your stance on that?
Well, I think basically I do think it's a fundamental issue. I mean, the stamp duty is just a very, very minor, incentive. Basically, I think the government should step in and provide more public housing, more home ownership scheme. Maybe there should be a two-tier home ownership scheme. At the end of the day, I mean, in George's manifesto, he's aiming at providing public housing to 60% of the population, maybe in 20 years' time. But I think we need to look at this target quite harshly. I mean, maybe we need to, raise it up. And of course, nowadays in Hong Kong, housing is not a necessity. It becomes a commodity. And no matter how much, transaction cost you are imposing on shares, for example, people are still buying shares because they think that the share price will go up. Same applies to the property market here. It becomes a commodity, and it is quite unthinkable that by increasing more supply you can try to deflate the price soar. I think the government should do more.
Stamp duty should be abolished, full stop. I mean, it's just a tax on the movement of assets. We don't tax, for example, if I buy a painting from Carmen, I won't be paying stamp duty on that. Why is it if I buy a flat from Carmen, I have to pay stamp duty on it? And certainly for first-time buyers, but I think for everybody, stamp duty should be abolished. I mean, it's a nonsense that we want to make property more affordable for first-time buyers, but we charge them up to 4.25% of what they're paying. When they're paying for it out of money they've already earned and paid salaries tax on, by the way. So, they may have paid the 15% rate of salaries tax, and now they're paying it again. Another 4.25% of that money gets taken away to buy the flat. It doesn't make any sense. We've already got a system where they, if you're not a first-time buyer, you pay 15% now. So in a sense, we're letting them off part of that. But why not let them off the whole amount and charge zero? It's much more sensible. I wouldn't have any caps on the amounts. And if you abolished stamp duty in the stock market as well, then you'd have a lot higher rate of turnover, because that's a frictional cost on transactions.
All right. David Cook, you get the last word. Do you have any thoughts on that, or is it outside your remit?
I guess that the key thing to think about is making sure that supply is elastic before there's any change in taxes on this, because otherwise it will just flow through into prices. And so there, it seems like that there's a lot of interesting ideas in the manifesto about land policy, and if that could be combined, I think it'd be a good idea.
Okay. Well, David Cook, professor in the Department of Economics at UST, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you to Carmen Young, who's chairman of the Taxation Institute, to David Webber, shareholder activist, founder of website.com, and Kenneth Lung, who's a legislator who represents the accountancy functional constituency. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us this morning.